Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockport for a talk by Frank A. Rose, Senior Fellow for Security and Strategy in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. The title of today's talk is Outer Space, Cooperation or Confrontation? Mr. Rose previously served as Principal Director and Chief of Government Relations at the Aerospace Corporation. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, President of the Midcoast Forum.
Welcome to the 434th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look, the president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the key factors influencing them. We are now in our 37th year of monthly meetings to hear an invited expert talk about issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy and to answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we're very pleased to have with us Frank Rose, who will be speaking on the future of outer space, cooperation or confrontation. Mr. Frank Rose is a senior fellow for security and strategy in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. He focuses on outer space, missile defense, nuclear strategy and deterrence, arms control, strategic stability, and emerging security challenges, quite a broad range of interests and expertise. From 2017 to 2018, he served as a principal director and chief of government relations at the Aerospace Corporation, which is a federally funded research and development center focused on national security and space. Mr. Rose served as Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance from 2014 to 2017. In this position, he was responsible for advising the Secretary of State on a wide variety of national security issues. From 2009 to 2014, he served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Space and Defense Policy. Prior to joining the State Department, Mr. Rose held various national security staff positions in the U.S. House of Representatives, including service as a professional staff member on both the House Armed Services Committee and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He has also held numerous positions within the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and he served on the staff of U.S. Senator John Kerry. Mr. Rose received his bachelor's degree in history from American University in 1994 and a master's degree in war studies from King's College, University of London in 1999. He is a recipient of numerous State Department, Defense Department, and international awards. Frank, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Great. Thanks very much. Well, George, thanks very much for that kind introduction. It's great to be back in New England. I am a fellow New Englander, but I'm from that state in the South. It will go unnamed, but this state was once part of that state. I am here today to talk about one of my favorite issues. As George noted in his introduction, I work a lot of issues, but outer space, in my view, is probably one of the most interesting because it touches so many other issues. The title of my talk today is Outer Space, Cooperation or Confrontation. This is an extremely timely topic, especially given the creation of the U.S. Space Force last year by Congress. That said, I'd like to accomplish three broad things today during my talk. First, I'll discuss why outer space and the information we receive from space-based systems is critical to almost everything we do here on Earth. Second, I'll outline what I think are the three key challenges to the long-term sustainability of the space environment. They are the growth of orbital debris, the emergence of mega constellations of small satellites, and the development and deployment of anti-satellite or ASAT weapons. And finally, what I'll do is actually provide some proposed recommendations on how we maintain the long-term sustainability, safety, security, and stability of the outer space environment. So with that said, let's discuss why space is so important. As I noted a few minutes ago, space is critical to just about everything we do here on Earth. Let me provide you some specific examples. Global positioning satellites allow us to navigate around the globe. Indeed, I used what we also know as GPS to drive here from Portland Airport. Weather satellites provide accurate predictions of the weather, warn us of from natural disasters like hurricanes, and monitor climate change. Communication satellites allow us to conduct telephone conversations, transmit radio and television signals, and communicate with our military forces around the world. Reconnaissance satellites allow us to track international political developments and monitor arms control agreements, something that I was responsible for at the State Department. Space is also used to advance global health. You know, for example, many countries in Africa and around the world suffer shortages of doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, and facilities. In recent years, many nations have been turning to space systems to help deal with this issue. For example, the European Space Agency, through the Satellite Africa eHealth Validation Program, is providing telemedicine services through satellite technology. This program connects regions in sub-Saharan Africa with hospitals in larger cities for medical services and educations. And these are just a couple of ways of how space is critical for what we do on Earth. I could actually spend all afternoon talking about this subject. However, today's outer space environment is evolving rapidly, presenting the United States and other nations with several key challenges to the sustainability, safety, stability, and security of the outer space environment. From my perspective, one of the biggest challenges is the growth of orbital debris. Decades of space activity have littered the Earth's orbit with defunct satellites and pieces of orbital debris. As activities in outer space continue to grow, the chances of a collision are also growing. The United States, through our space surveillance network, tracks over 26,000 pieces of orbital debris, 10 centimeters or larger, in various Earth orbits. Approximately 2,200 of these objects are active satellites. Other objects include spent rocket bodies, inactive satellites, a wrench, and believe it or not, even a toothbrush. Don't ask me how this toothbrush got up there, but this is true. Additionally, as many as 600,000 other pieces of orbital debris that are smaller than 10 centimeters exist that we currently don't have the capability to track, but they could still cause significant damage if a collision occurred. Experts warn that the current quantity and density of man-made debris is significantly increasing the odds of future collisions, either as debris damages systems or as colliding debris hits itself and creates more debris, which is known as Kessler syndrome. Because of the high speeds in which these objects travel, 17,500 miles per hour, even a sub-millimeter piece of debris could cause a major problem. There's a, I wouldn't say it's a wonderful picture, I would say there's an interesting picture that shows how like a 4-centimeter piece of debris, I think it was a paint chip, hit one of the space shuttles and it almost cracked the space shuttle. So this is dangerous stuff. The chart on the screen above was prepared by NASA in 2016, illustrates the dramatic growth in the amount of debris since the dawn of the space age in 1957. And you look at the bottom, I think, left-hand corner where you see, there was almost nothing, but track that brown line. That's just a total objects in outer space. And it shows you just dramatic increase in debris. Now, some of this debris is the result of routine space operations. For example, when a rocket takes off, leaves orbit, it leaves spent rocket bodies. While others are the results of deliberate acts and accidents. Now, on that note, I'd like to focus your attention on two specific events that occurred in 2007 and 2009, respectively. In 2007, China conducted a destructive anti-satellite test against one of its own satellites at 865 kilometers in outer space. That single event created over 3,000 pieces of debris larger than 10 centimeters, which will stay in low Earth orbit for potentially hundreds of years, presenting an ongoing threat to the space systems of all nations, including China. Indeed, over the past decade or so, there have been close to 1,000 times when debris from China's ASAT test have come close to their own satellite. Now, the United States, not necessarily out of the goodness of our hearts, we have notified the Chinese every time this has happened. Because from our perspective, if a piece of debris hits a Chinese satellite, that creates more debris. It puts our satellites at risk. And I had a lot of engagement with the Chinese when I was at the State Department. And every time I met with Chinese officials, I would call the Department of Defense and ask them for the numbers of close approaches or conjunctions that we had sent to the Chinese where pieces of debris from their satellite tests had come close to their own satellites, and I'd give it to them. And every time we've met, there'd be hundreds and hundreds of more. It's really cutting off your nose despite your face. And, you know, some of these collisions have been accidents. Like in 2009, there was a collision between the Russian Cosmos satellite and a commercially operated Iridium satellite. Now, these two events, and you see the destruction of the Fengyang 1C and the collision between Iridium and Cosmos, those two events are responsible for 1/3 of all the debris in low Earth orbit. So you can see that the growth of orbital debris is a major problem. That said, I think the United States has taken strong leadership under both Democratic and Republican administrations to address the orbital debris challenge through several important steps. First, it is improving space situational awareness capabilities, or SSA capabilities for short. And what SSA capabilities are, it's a system of radars, telescopes, and satellites that allow us to track, characterize, and catalog objects in outer space. And let me just give you another chart up here. This just is another way that illustrates the growth of orbital debris. In 1960, there was almost nothing there. In 2010, look at how bad it's gotten, and it's gotten worse since 2010. So we have, through the U.S. Air Force, an organization called the 18th Space Control Squadron, located at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And this organization publishes a catalog of space objects and warns global space operators, including foreign governments and commercial operators, of potential collisions free of charge. However, at some point in the future, this mission will transfer to a civilian agency to allow the Department of Defense to focus more on traditional warfighting missions. The Trump administration indeed has proposed transferring the mission to the U.S. Department of Commerce, but Congress has not yet approved that proposal. Now, additionally to some of the internal U.S. activities, we've also been working over the past decades in the international realm to develop norms of behavior to help mitigate this debris challenge. Through the Interagency Debris Coordination Committee, which consists of representatives from the world's major space agencies, and the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And what these two organizations have tried to do is put voluntary guidelines in place to help reduce the growth of debris. And for the most part, they have helped, but it's very clear to me that more needs to be done on the international level. And I'll come back to that in my conclusion. Now, the second key challenge facing the outer space environment is the development of mega constellations of small satellites. Now, several U.S. and European entities have plans to launch mega constellations of satellites in the coming years. The Federal Communications Commission has approved a request by SpaceX to construct, deploy, and operate a new low Earth constellation of more than 12,000 small satellites. And this picture is a picture of 60 of these small satellites that SpaceX launched into orbit in January of this year. And on top of these 12,000 small satellites that the FCC has approved, SpaceX has asked the FCC over the next couple of years to approve an additional 30,000 satellites for a total of 42,000 satellites. Now, these satellites will be used to improve broadband communications globally. And other companies around the world have plans to deploy similar constellations. For example, OneWeb, which is a European consortium, launched about 35 satellites last week, I think on February 4th or 5th. Now, while these mega constellations will improve space-based capabilities, they will also contribute significantly to congestion in low Earth orbit. Duh. NASA orbital experts have highlighted this concern in a recent study on the potential impact of large satellite constellations. J.C. Liu, NASA chief scientist for orbital debris, has stated, "Because of the large number of spacecraft involved, these companies need to pay attention to certain areas to make sure they do not pollute near-Earth space environment with significant orbital debris." To address this challenge, NASA experts have recommended ensuring that satellites in constellations be deorbited at the end of their respective service life so that they don't just get stuck in orbit. As these mega constellations begin to be deployed, it will be important that they are done in a way that is fully consistent with debris mitigation standards. In their decision approving the SpaceX constellation, the FCC required that the company come back to the commission with an updated plan for debris mitigation, noting that unchecked, growing debris in orbit could make some regions of space unusable for decades to come. That is why we need to develop a comprehensive policy to mitigate collision risk and ensure space sustainability. And it's important to note, it's not just US and European entities who are moving forward with these mega constellations. In December 2018, a Chinese state-owned satellite manufacturing company launched the first demonstration satellite for the Hongyan communications constellation of small satellites. This constellation will ultimately consist of 320 satellites and is expected to be fully operational by 2025. Now, though this constellation is significantly smaller than Starlink proposed by SpaceX, it is likely only a matter of time before China's approach to mega constellations becomes more ambitious, making it imperative that the United States begin discussions with China on this very important issue. A third key challenge to the outer space environment is the growing threat from anti-satellite or ASAT weapons. Throughout the Cold War, both the United States and the Soviet Union developed limited numbers of ASAT weapons, but they never really moved forward with large-scale deployments of these weapons, given the concerns that the damage that ASAT weapons could do to the sustainability of the outer space environment. For example, the United States and the Soviet Union both tested nuclear weapons in outer space. One of the most famous of these tests was the Starfish Prime test in 1962, in which the United States detonated a 1.4 megaton hydrogen bomb 248 miles above Earth. This reminds me of a story. A couple of years ago, I was with my mother, and I took her on vacation with me on the sidelines of a trip I did to Paris. And we went down to Bordeaux, and we were at a lovely French or Gascon restaurant, let me get that correct, and having a lovely bottle of wine. And, you know, as we get older, you know how we ask our parents questions that we didn't ask them when we were young. And I asked her, "Ma, you and Dad had absolutely nothing in common." And so, and they've been divorced for 30 years. Why did you get married? And her response to me, without winking an idea, was, "Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time." And that's kind of like testing nuclear weapons in outer space. Hey, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So let's go back to 1962, Starfish Prime test. We detonate a 1.4 megaton nuclear weapon in outer space. As a result, we knock out the communications in the western part of the United States for several hours, and we also severely damaged or destroyed six satellites, one British, four American and one Soviet. So, I mean, then, you know, after that, President Kennedy said, ooh, maybe this is not a good idea to test nuclear weapons out of space. And about a year later, a year and a half later, we signed the Limited Test Ban Treaty, or the Partial Test Ban Treaty. Now, yes, that is focused on above-ground nuclear testing for environmental reasons, but it's also about the space environment. One, it prevented tests in the atmosphere. And did you know, had we continued to test nuclear weapons in outer space, we probably would have put so much radiation in the Van Allen belt, human spaceflight might not have been possible. Now, the good news is, with the end of the Cold War, the development of ASAT weapons declined significantly. But that changed in 2007 when China conducted that direct descent ASAT test that I talked about. They fired a missile at one of their defunct weather satellites. Which created a big problem. So the question that we have is, the United States and the Soviet Union decided really not to go down the road of ASAT weapons. And so the question is, what prompted this renewed interest in ASAT weapons? I would say the renewed interest in ASAT weapons was driven by the increasing importance that space-based systems play in military operations. This applies particularly to military operations conducted by the United States. The United States' potential adversaries, in particular Russia and China, understand that space-based assets allow the United States to project power globally. Satellites enable the U.S. military to detect, track, and target adversaries, as well as provide command and control of its own forces. The ability to deny the United States access to space-derived data would provide adversaries significant military advantage. As former U.S. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats testified before Congress last January, quote, China and Russia are training and equipping their military forces in fielding new anti-satellite weapons to hold U.S. and allied space services at risk. Both countries recognize that the world's growing reliance on space and view the capability to attack space services as part of their broader effort to deter an adversary or defeat one in combat. This chart just shows you the full spectrum of anti-satellite weapons. On one end of the spectrum, you have what you call the reversible capabilities. Cyber attack capabilities, jammers, lasers to dazzle and temporarily disable a satellite. On the other side, you have what you call the non-reversible systems. These are primarily kinetic systems, basically sea, air, or land-based missile interceptors that can basically destroy a satellite. And Russia and China, as I discussed, are developing a full spectrum of these capabilities. In addition to the hardware, as Director Coates noted, they are also organizing their forces to operate more effectively in space. For example, in 2015, China created a new branch of their military called the Strategic Support Force. The objective of the Strategic Support Force is to better coordinate space, cyber, and electronic warfare capabilities. Also in 2015, Russia established the Aerospace Defense Force with a similar message. Now, we've heard a lot about the Space Force, which the United States created last year, but I think it's important to note that the Chinese and the Russians have been thinking about this and taking actions to conduct operations in outer space long before the United States.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Frank A. Rose discussing cooperation or confrontation in outer space.
So, given all of these challenges to the space environment that I've outlined, what approach should the United States take in response? In many ways, I think the United States faces a fundamental dilemma. And that is, as it attempts to maintain, and that is as follows. On one hand, Russia's development of anti-satellite weapons represent a threat to U.S. and allied space systems. On the other hand, it is difficult to see how the United States and the international community will be able to address these key challenges, specifically the growth of orbital debris and the rise of mega constellations, without engaging actively with both Russia and China. So, recognizing this dilemma, let me make some recommendations that could serve as the basis for a potential U.S. strategy. I think first, the United States should work to improve international cooperation on space situational awareness. The Department of Defense has been doing a great job on this over the past decade. I think we need to take specific steps to improve that, both from a coordination point of view, but also improving our capabilities. Second, we need to work with our international partners, including Russia and China, to develop stronger norms of behavior to address the challenge of orbital debris. One of the things that I would recommend is that the United States work to develop some type of ban or limitation on further debris-generating events in outer space. This could take various forms, such as declaring a unilateral moratorium on debris-generating events, developing a bilateral or multilateral moratorium with countries like China, or potentially negotiating a legally binding treaty. Related to that is this whole issue of mega constellations. We need to have an international discussion about how we regulate the rise of these mega constellations, because if not done correctly, it could really pollute the outer space environment. Third, I think the United States must enhance the deterrence and increase the resiliency of their national security space architecture. Important note here, many of the things that you see that have been outlined by the Trump administration actually began during the Obama administration. For example, in 2015, in response to the ASAT threat, the U.S. increased funding for space security initiatives by $5 billion. And in many ways, the Trump administration's proposal to create the U.S. Space Force and reestablish U.S. Space Command is fundamentally about enhancing deterrence and increasing the resiliency of our space architecture. Fourth, the United States needs to engage China diplomatically and through other ways on outer space. During the Obama administration, we actually had a very robust discussion in the last several years with China. Indeed, I chaired the first ever U.S.-China space talks in 2016. Unfortunately, those talks have not met since 2016. I think one of the first steps that the administration could do would be to restart those talks. Furthermore, I think we really need to look at partnering with China on some civil space projects, perhaps inviting them to join the International Space Station. We just can't have a stick with regards to China. We also have to find opportunities for cooperation. And this is not the first time that the United States has found a way to cooperate with a peer competitor in outer space. In 1972, the United States and Soviet Union agreed to the Apollo-Soyuz docking mission, which occurred in 1975. As Michael Crapon of the Stimson Center has written, some feared that this mission would compromise the U.S. space program while providing further rewards to the Soviet program. These anxieties proved to be overdrawn. The Apollo-Soyuz mission established practices of cooperation in space between Washington and Moscow that continue to this day on the International Space Station. From my perspective, if we could find a way to cooperate with the Soviets at the height of the Cold War, we should be able to find a way to cooperate with China. So let me conclude by saying, cooperation or confrontation? That is the question. As the 2007 U.S. National Security Strategy notes, the United States has indeed returned to an era of renewed great power competition with both Russia and China. But as my colleague, Tom Wright, also a senior fellow at Brookings, outlined in his recent book, All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, quote, as the United States competes with Russia and China, it cannot lose sight of the many areas in which the United States must cooperate with its rivals out of shared interests. The issue is whether it is possible to cooperate on these problems while competing on others. This is the essential balance we need to strike with regards to outer space. Finding a way to work with states like Russia and China on space sustainability and safety issues, while at the same time pushing back on security areas where necessary. And on that note, let me stop and turn the floor back over to George for questions.
Thank you very much, Frank. While they're gathering questions from our members and guests, you have me very concerned about these mega constellations, actually. And, you know, you talked about the U.S. wanting to launch 40,000 and the Chinese then. And then you said one of your recommendations is international discussions on this. Seems like the problem needs a little more than international cooperation in the future. Yeah. Are there any efforts going on now? I mean, if we think that we own space and do it, and the Chinese as well, aren't we going to have conflict?
Yeah. I think we need to have not just discussions, but we need to have an international agreement. You know, I am very, very hesitant to say we can stop the deployment of these types of systems, because when there's a lot of money to be made, it is really difficult to stop people from doing things. However, I think the key is ensuring, as NASA has outlined, that when we launch these mega constellations, one, they have enough fuel to be deorbited, number one. And number two, I think we have to work better on space situational awareness, also known as space traffic management. As I mentioned in my remarks, the United States has the best network in the world. But one of the things with tracking objects in space, it's all about geography. So if you can improve the sensors that you can have, you can improve your SSA capability. So fundamentally, at the end of the day, it comes down to putting standards in place that require deorbiting at the appropriate time, and also improving international space situational awareness, coordination, and cooperation.
And just to follow up on that, you know, is this Is it good enough to do this bilaterally, such as agreements with China or India, or do we really need to create an international arrangement, a norm?
Yeah, I think we will eventually have to create a broad international norm. But as someone who has worked in the multilateral international space throughout my career, especially at the State Department, the way you create viable international norms is you have to get buy-in from the major powers. So I call it an inside-out approach. I would start with the key countries, the U.S., China, Russia, European Space Agency, India, and Brazil, to see if you can reach consensus amongst those nations. And once you reach consensus, you take it to the broader international community. Indeed, that's what was done in 2007 when we created the UN Debris Mitigation Guidelines. The UN Debris Mitigation Guidelines, approved by the UN back in 2007, were basically the result of a consensus agreement by the major space powers.
Thank you. There's actually a large number of people referring to hoovering space. Can anyone work up a space-age vacuum cleaner? Other than deorbiting, and maybe you could address how you deorbit a satellite, how else can you clean up space? Can you get a vacuum cleaner up there?
You know, the bottom line is, it's an excellent question. I've been talking about space junk for many years. Actually, my mother once said, when she read an article about me that called me the ambassador for space junk, she goes, "Frank, I finally know what you do." there are numerous ways you can deal with orbital debris. Probably the easiest thing you do is you put enough fuel in the satellite, so when it's coming to the end of its service life, you can take it back to Earth, and you mostly land it in the ocean. So that's number one. Number two, and this is an interesting thing, we have been hearing a lot about what they call active debris removal. And what active debris removal is basically putting satellites in outer space with grappling hooks and other technologies where you can actually go and pick out some of these large pieces of debris. And I'll be honest with you, that technology is out there, okay? And there is a strong argument to do this, because I mentioned Kessler syndrome during my talk. And what Kessler syndrome is that debris, it doesn't stay in one place. It moves and it collides and creates more debris. There have been studies that if you go up and take some of the bigger pieces of debris, that will help manage the growth of debris. But the challenge active debris removal, as I like to say, is one person's active debris removal system is another one's anti-satellite weapon. It's inherently dual capable. I would bet you a lot of money that if China said, "We have an active debris removal satellite with grappling hooks," the United States wouldn't necessarily think that was about active debris removal. So I think if there's any area for international cooperation and transparency, this is the area. And furthermore, I would also note that this is an area where the technology is actually ahead of the regulation. For example, there are salvage laws and procedures on the sea. Nothing quite similar exists for outer space. But again, I think this is an area for international cooperation. But an excellent question. Bottom line is, active debris removal can help us deal with the growing debris in space.
How about requiring insurance of the companies putting this up against collisions, assuming that accidental collisions will raise the cost of all of this? Has that been an an approach that anyone's talked about?
Well, there is insurance. I'm not an international insurance space law expert, but there is some insurance. But I think the bottom line is we have to put in place stronger norms to deal with this challenge. Now, I understand legally binding agreements are tough, and I would not recommend legally binding agreements just because, one, it's difficult to negotiate internationally, but I have a hard time seeing the U.S. Senate agreeing to it. I think if you look at regards to outer space, the history over the last 40 years, it has really been focused on soft law, the UN Debris Mitigation Guidelines in 2007. The UN Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, their long-term sustainability guidelines, which were approved finally in 2019. Now, yes, these are voluntary guidelines, but there's nothing that prevents nations from taking those voluntary guidelines and putting them in their domestic legal and regulatory frameworks.
Here's a question about whether we have enough redundancy in space. With the space debris problem, is there redundancy built into our communications and weather satellites so there's always a backup?
There is some redundancy, but I would say with regards to the debris issue, things are manageable, okay? I think where we are particularly concerned about with regards to redundancy is the anti-satellite threat. You know, the United States military and the intelligence community build really big, really good satellites, but they are very vulnerable. The Russians and the Chinese have a pretty good idea where they are. So if you're actually in a conflict, you've got some problems. So one of the things that we have seen over the past several years is an attempt to enhance the resiliency of our national security space architecture. And we're doing that through a couple of ways. One, moving to smaller satellites so we don't provide big, juicy targets. Two, working more closely with our allies. I always like to say, the U.S. system of alliances and partnerships on the international sphere is one of our asymmetric advantages. And I, when I was in government, worked very, very closely with a number of allies, both bilaterally and multilaterally, to see where we could cooperate. For example, potentially hosting payloads on allied satellites. Working with the European Union to get access to their Galileo system, which is similar to our GPS. And the thinking behind that is, if a potential adversary could ever jam GPS, we would want our military forces to have access to Galileo to build in that redundancy. And then finally, George, what I would say is we need to enhance our non-space infrastructure. Space systems are inherently vulnerable. So we need to think about things like UAVs, fiber optic cables, and other technological fixes. Now, they won't replace the importance of space, but they can provide some additional resiliency.
Here's a question I find extremely interesting. Has there been any study of space's capacity for satellites? How much stuff can we put up there?
Well, space is a big place. I think when we talk about the crowded nature of space, it is in low Earth orbit. And, you know, we can put a lot of stuff in low Earth orbit before it gets totally crowded. But at the end of the day, especially for private industry, it comes down to a business model decision. Because every time you have to maneuver that satellite, that takes away fuel and lessens the life of that satellite. So we can actually put a lot of stuff in low Earth orbit. And if you look at all these plans, we are going to put a lot of stuff in low Earth orbit. The question is, what can we do in a way that allows us to reap the benefits of those new mega satellite constellations, but at the same time, doesn't make it more expensive and present threats to the safety in low Earth orbit? And that's going to be the challenge.
Here's one wondering about how the Chinese think about this. In your opinion, did the Chinese conduct a risk analysis before they did the ASAT test? And what has been their reaction to the reports you provided them on the close encounters with debris?
Yeah.
How seriously do they take
this?
This
is an excellent question. If you go back to 2007, I think the Chinese had no real idea what they were going to do. Again, seemed like a good idea at the time. I'm sure they went, I think it was probably Hu Jintao was the president back then. The technical guy said, "Hey, Mr. President, this is a great idea. We'll show the Americans that we're serious." So they went and they blew it up, and they said, "Oops." For a while, and this was fun, we really bashed the Chinese internationally for a couple of years. And I know it feels good. I mean, but at some point you say, okay, are we actually solving the problem? And the answer is no. I always remember a young lady, her name was Jaisha, she worked on my staff. And she came into my office saying, "Frank, the JSPOC needs your permission to provide this notification to the Chinese on a close approach between a piece of debris from their satellite and tests in 2007 and one of their existing satellites." And I looked at her, I was like, "Really?" But then I caught myself and I said, "Boy," as I noted a little bit earlier, "if that piece of debris hits their satellite, creates more debris, that gives us, that creates problems for us." So after that moment, I said, we need to engage China. Now, I talked about the Vandenberg Air Force Base and how they provide these notifications to operators around the world, both governments and non-governments. Now, it used to be that with regards to China, we had to send those notifications from Vandenberg Air Force Base to the State Department in Washington. State Department would send it to our embassy in Beijing. Our embassy in Beijing would send the notification to the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then we would hope that the notification got to the right people in China. We don't do that with any other nation. Usually it's a direct connection between Vandenberg Air Force Base, used to be the Joint Space Operations Center, but they changed the name recently, and the appropriate space operator or control center. I said, this is crazy. So one of the things that we did back in late 2004, 2005, is we established a direct link between the U.S. Air Force and the Beijing Institute for Technology and Telecommunications, which was a good thing. Then we started engaging the Chinese more. For example, I talked about the U.S.-China space security talks, which I founded and chaired for the United States. We also came very close, though we did not get it over the finish line before the end of the Obama administration, coming up with a joint declaration at the presidential level to encourage each other, encourage the international community not to conduct debris generation of in outer space. So the bottom line is, I think the Chinese have learned their lesson. They've been very pragmatic over the past couple of years. I think the Trump administration needs to engage the Chinese on these issues. Now, I have generally been supportive of many of the things that they are doing with regards to the military side of the house, but one big gaping hole in their space strategy is a lack of engagement with China. And you're not going to be able to solve the challenge of China through military solutions alone.
Then here's, I'm skipping around a little bit and I apologize, but I don't always see these questions right away. If our adversaries are equally dependent on satellite technology, doesn't that remove the likelihood of anti-satellite weapons?
I would say, though our adversaries are developing and deploying their own space capabilities, they are not as dependent as we are for space systems. And that comes down to a very basic point. When you look at the potential areas where we would come into conflict with Russia and China, it's a home game for them, okay? They will be operating, as you know, Clausewitz once said, on interior lines of communication. So very, very close to their territory. And yes, they depend on space systems, but they also have fiber optic cables and other communications capabilities. We are projecting military power across the globe, in the Western Pacific, in the Baltics. Therefore, we are much more reliant on space capabilities than they are. And that, I would argue, is one of the reasons why they are investing in anti-satellite weapons. And one point I think it's important to make is you can't separate space from some of these other strategic domains. Cyber, electronic warfare, undersea communications cables, these things are all interconnected. And if you look at how the Chinese and the Russians and other adversaries have organized their militaries over the last 25 years, they are focused on developing niche military capabilities designed to prevent the United States from bringing its information advantage to the battlefield. So again, you can't think of space separated from these other strategic domains.
Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Frank A. Rose, Senior Fellow for Security and Strategy in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He recently spoke with the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations on cooperation or confrontation in outer space. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.